Following reading is taken from Revival Sketches and Manual by Heman Humphrey, President of Amherst College, Chapter 4, The Revival Epoch, about 1800. Passing from the glorious revival period, about the middle of the last century, under the preaching of Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, the two tenants, Joseph Bellamy, and other apostolic laborers, we find the shadows of a long night settling down again upon the churches of this land. Like Israel of old, most of them were in the wilderness about 40 years and only kept alive by supplies of the heavenly manna and of the water from the rock. From 1745 to near the close of the century, the Holy Spirit withheld in a great measure those copious refreshings which had turned so many parched fields into gardens of the Lord and made their fruit shake like Lebanon. At no time, indeed, during that period was it all dark and all barren. All along here and there, over the wide waste, some precious revivals broke out, like streams in the desert, to keep alive the faith and gladden the hearts of those who mourned over the desolations of Zion. Towards the close of the period, there were more of these than I had supposed till I met with notices of several unmistakable geniuses between 1770 and 1790 in New England and the Middle States, including the new settlements of western Pennsylvania, and with some further south, especially as recorded in Archibald Alexander's narrative of what he himself witnessed in southern and western Virginia about 1790. These were the harbingers of that bright rising of the sun of righteousness, which I am now approaching in these revival sketches. See the life of Archibald Alexander by James Waddell Alexander, chapters 2-4. It had been a long, hard winter, in which the current of spiritual life was all but frozen up, and it seemed almost as if the winding sheet which was spread over the land would never be taken off. But at the same time, precious fruits of the great harvest, which had been garnered, remained. None of the churches, I believe, that had renounced the halfway covenant in the Great Awakening brought it back again, though it still lingered in churches which that revival, if it reached them at all, left but half reformed. I found it in Fairfield, Connecticut, where I was first settled in 1807. Some other churches in that county had not yet given it up. It was also found in some of the Presbyterian churches, and it prevailed extensively for some time longer in the eastern and central parts of Massachusetts. If it still darkens a half-open door of any evangelical church, I do not know where it is. Other vantage ground was gained in the Great Awakening, from which the churches did not slide back. But although when a brighter day dawned near the close of the century, it was not necessary to lay again the foundation of repentance from dead works and a faith towards God, as in the preceding Reformation, the building did not go up. Dark days intervened, during which, instead of making any aggressive inroads upon the kingdom of darkness, the churches seemed to lose ground. The fathers and mothers who had been converted under Jonathan Edwards and the other rousing preachers of his day were passing off from the stage, and but few of the younger generation were coming on to fill their places. Many Orthodox churches might be named, into which for long years no young persons, or next to none, were received. Most of the ministers, indeed, where the great revivals in the middle of the century had been enjoyed, were sound in the faith, and preached the distinguishing doctrines of the gospel. In obedience to the word of the Lord, they kept on prophesying over the dry bones, but for the most part were constrained to ask, "Who has believed our report? And to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed?" While they did not cease to pray, "O Lord, revive thy work in the midst of the years, in wrath remember mercy," they hardly dared to hope for so great a blessing. Such is the state of things till near the close of the century. We are next to inquire what were the causes of the alarming dearth and declension just mentioned before we hailed the dawn of a brighter day. And looking back upon that period, some of these causes are too obvious to be mistaken. First came what is familiarly called the Old French War, While we slept, the enemy, ever awake and aggressive, had been skillfully drawn a line of circumvallation quite round the English armies, to hem us in, by a building of chain forts from Louisburg and Quebec on the north, by the way of Detroit and St. Louis down to the mouth of the Mississippi. And now it was that France, aided by the warlike tribes of Indians whom she could enlist in the bloody enterprise, sought to bring all North America under the yoke of Rome. God interposed, and the attempt signally failed. But the danger, while it lasted, created universal alarm, and the necessary defense of the frontiers demanded all the force that could be raised and absorbed the anxious minds of the whole population. In this state of things, it would have been strange indeed if the churches had been visited by revivals, if the cause of Christ had not declined as it did. Scarcely was that danger over when serious difficulties broke out between the colonists and the mother country, and continued to increase until they issued in the War of the Revolution. Here again, it would have been very remarkable if in the midst of all these agitations of the then infant settlements, revivals had sprung up. They did not. Humanly speaking, there was no room for them. And we know that God works by means and favorable seasons and orders events for building up his churches, as well as for accomplishing his other great purposes. When the War of Independence broke out in 1775, the state of the country was, if possible, still more unfavorable to the progress of true religion. It was a struggle for colonial emancipation, with one of the most powerful nations of the world, which lasted 7 years, during which the shifting and sometimes the almost despairing fortunes of the bloody contest swallowed up every other interest. So then, instead of revival rejoicings, were heard the confused noise of the battle of the warriors, the thunder of the captains, and the shouting. In such a state of things, when the American armies were wading through frost and blood to conquer national independence, and the anxious hopes and fears of the whole people were alternately swallowed up in a mighty struggle, how could religion prosper? The Spirit of God is the spirit of peace and not of war. I know that God is able to build up his churches in the midst of wars and fighting, just as he is able to awaken and convert hardened sinners under the most unfavorable circumstances, but this is not his manner. To show that he will have mercy on whom he will have mercy, and that he can carry on his work in spite of the most hostile influences, he may work wonders. But how few revivals have ever been witnessed in the midst of a desolating war? If any, they have been extraordinary interpositions of divine sovereignty. Some may have occurred during the 7 years' war, but if any, I do not know where to find the record. Certain I am that that bloody contest was directly opposed, as all wars are, to the spiritual growth of the churches. It left them much weaker than it had found them. When it closed and the armies were disbanded, many of the officers and soldiers brought home with them the dissipated and demoralizing habits of the camp, such as profaneness and temperance and Sabbath breaking, influences as hostile to revivals as the war itself. And scarcely less so was the unseen state of affairs throughout the country, until a new government was organized and established by the adoption of the federal constitution. The minds of the people were too much agitated and engrossed by conflicting political interests to have much room for more than the ordinary routine of religious observances. Revivals were hardly expected anywhere during those years of civil agitation, and they were not enjoyed. Zion languished. While the form of godliness remained in the churches, there was but little of the power. In the meantime, as might have been expected, French infidelity, which our allies brought over with them, was sowed, broadcast among their own officers and soldiers. Aided by Thomas Paine's Age of Reason, Voltaire's assaults upon Christianity, Volney's ruins, and other blasphemous publications, it spread rapidly, especially among the upper classes. The Illuminati, so-called, of France and Germany, who were secretly associated for the overthrow of all existing religious institutions, had their affiliated societies in this country, enrolling not a few men of high social and political standing and influence. It became fashionable in high places and low places flippantly to prate against the Bible and sneer at things sacred and divine. Instead of the scriptures, French philosophy claimed to be the rule of faith and life, and ignoring all the rights of God was to usher in the glorious millennium of the rights of man. Towards the close of that period, in 1789, broke out the French Revolution, the bloodiest of all revolutions, which was not only to sweep away the throne and level all the civil distinctions of society, but to destroy the priesthood, root and branch, abolished the Sabbath, and established a reign of liberty and equality on the ruins. Though the unheard-of atrocities of that reign of terror sent a thrill of horror through the whole civilized world, so dear was our new-born liberty to us that the very name had a charm in it which at first excited our fraternal sympathies, notwithstanding our abhorrence of the fiendish atrocities by which it had been sought to be acquired. How hostile all this was to the interests of pure and undefiled religion, it is needless to say. And when from this point we look back to the reaction which followed the Great Awakening, and then come down through the Revolutionary War to the Return of Peace, which brought with it the moral camp distemper that wars always degenerate, and glance at the agitations of the public mind which preceded the adoption of the Federal Constitution, who can wonder that there were so few revivals, or rather not wonder that there were any, during all that upheaving, tempestuous period? It seemed as if the floods of ungodliness must swallow up the church. The few survivors who remembered the days of old when multitudes were gathered in the times of refreshing from the presence of the Lord were ready to ask, "Are the mercies of God clean gone forever? Will he be favorable no more?" But just then, when it seemed to grow darker and darker, the night was far spent and the day was at hand. A few years before the close of the century, the light of a new revival epoch began to dawn. Here and there a church rose and shook herself from the dust. Sinners were awakened and began to inquire what they must do to be saved. So that when the old century was departing and a new century came in, many a field that had long been languishing began to rejoice under the reviving influence. Christ by his Spirit came down here and there, like rain upon the mown grass, and like showers that water the earth. It is of the commencement and progress and fruits of that remarkable revival epoch that I am now to speak, reserving for subsequent pages a notice of the remarkable work which God was effecting simultaneously in the mother country. And here ample materials are at hand for a volume, and in narratives drawn up at the time by pastors of the churches, and published in the Connecticut Evangelical Magazine and other religious annals. Of these I shall avail myself as far as my design and limits will admit. And here let me say it is with no ordinary solicitude that I approach this remarkable revival epoch. The theme is high. I cannot attain unto it. O Lord, help my infirmities. It is a gloriously illuminated chapter in the history of redemption. It were easy to collect material more than enough, but to condense and arrange them in the best manner, to show in what respects this revival epoch differed from those in the preceding centuries at which I have already glanced. To gather up its precious fruits and to show its bearing upon the further advancement of the Redeemer's kingdom is a task which, so far as I know, has not yet been accomplished by anyone, and in which I feel myself very unequal. Nevertheless, a plan which I have marked out for chronicling the triumphs of the cross in these sketches does not allow me to shrink from the attempt. When this fresh outpouring of the Spirit began, I was just coming upon the stage, and God had cast my lot in that part of the vineyard where the gospel had been faithfully preached by ministers who were anxiously waiting for the Savior's return. I knew them, and often heard them preach before and during the revivals. Now, after more than 50 years, I have a distinct recollection of their countenance, their tones of voice, their earnest and solemn appeals, their going out and coming in among the people. They had diversities of natural gifts and acquired qualifications, but the same Spirit. There was no such massive pillar among them as Jonathan Edwards to lean upon. It wasn't needed. There was no George Whitfield to pass from town to town, from state to state, gathering the thousands in the open air, and swaying them by his soul and tongue of fire, as the trees of a forest are bowed and shaken by mighty winds. There was no voice like his to fill the open firmament of heaven with the thunderings of Sinai and the melting tones of Calvary. But there were the Joseph Bellamy's to stand upon the heights and make the curses of the law reverberate from Ebal to Gerizim, and from Gerizim to Ebal. As in the primitive age, there were sons of thunder and sons of consolation among them. There was the younger Jonathan Edwards, a great master of logic and mighty in the scriptures. There was Edward Dort Griffin, having just buckled on the harness, a young Melanchthon in the ardor of his first love for Christ, majestic in stature, with a voice of extraordinary flexibility and power, combining some of the finest tones of the organ with the softest and tenderest notes of the flute. I thought then, and think now, that I never heard such a voice in the pulpit. He was a great preacher in the best sense of the term, and his labors, as we shall see, were abundantly blessed in winning souls to Christ. And then there was Halleck, quite his counterpart in some respects, bred a farmer in one of the small hill towns of Massachusetts, untrained in the higher schools, meek as the meekest disciple, always readier to say, "Brother, go up higher," than to go himself, but a man of good natural talents, shrewd, common sense, deep, humble, piety, and an irrepressible longing after souls in the bowels of Jesus Christ. He came late into the ministry and without the slightest pretension to popular address or rhetoric, became one of the most honored, beloved, and useful ministers of his day. No one was more acceptable in that revival than he. Nor were these more worthy or devoted than many others. There were Robbins and Isaac Backus, Samuel Mills and Gillette, Perkins and Strong and Porter and Hooker and Miller and Williams and Cooley and Holly and Cowles of like precious faith, whose lips the Lord touched as with live coals from off the altar, whose parishes were contiguous, and whose labors were abundantly blessed. Most of them belonged to the same district association. They held their monthly meetings for mutual improvement and prayer, in which they wrestled together and prevailed. I have named them, not as more worthy to be had in everlasting remembrance than Timothy Dwight, Alvin Hyde, Catlin, Stillman, Baldwin, Manning, Mason, and Livingston, Furman Marshall, and many others of their brethren. In other parts of the vineyard that were copiously watered by the same showers, but because I knew and heard them and witnessed the effects of their labors, their preaching was not in man's wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and with power. It was eminently scriptural. The ministers of that day read and studied the Bible more than all other books. They had received it from their master as their only commission, and in virtue of it, as ambassadors for Christ, they besought sinners in his stead to be reconciled to God. It was surprising to notice with what facility they would quote chapter and verse from all parts of both testaments without turning over a single leaf. Indeed, it sometimes seemed to me as if they knew all the Bible by heart, and it is no disparagement to say that they did know much more of it than most preachers do now. They had a great deal more of it in their sermons. Almost all of their illustrations, as well as their proofs, were drawn from its rich and inexhaustible treasures. "Thus saith the Lord" was enough for them. Let who would criticize, cavil, or blaspheme. They did not shun either from fear or favor to declare all the counsel of God as they understood it, whether men would hear or whether they would forbear. They did not wreathe the sword around with flowers, but left the two edges bare and sharp to cut where they would, the deeper the better, and they applied no emoluments to heal the hurt slightly. The fathers of the day of whom I am speaking, whatever else any of them may have lacked, were Gamaliels in the law and the prophets. They made no appeals to the passions, and there were no outcries and convulsions under their preaching, as there had been in the Great Awakening. The Word of God, as our minister used it, was quick and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, and piercing even to the dividing asunder of the joints and the marrow, and discerning the thoughts and intents of the heart. Oh, how we smarted under it! I remember it well in my own case and how my heart rebelled against some of the doctrines which my Bible and my conscience told me were true till, as I hope, I was brought to bow and submit at the foot of the cross. And as it was with me, so it was with multitudes of others. We complained of some of Paul's hard sayings and wondered why our ministers dwelt so much upon them. We wanted to get to heaven in some easier way, but instead of abating one jot or tittle to relieve us, they pressed harder and harder, driving us from one refuge to another, until there was no hiding place left. The law which we had broken times without number, we were made to feel was just. Its fiery penalty hung over our heads, and we must submit or die. Under such preaching, it was hard to get hopes. But when embraced, they were more to be relied upon than if they had been gained in some easier way. Our spiritual guides and teachers never said to us when under awakening, "Don't be discouraged. Wait God's time and he will deliver you." No, no. But how long will you hold out in your rebellion against God? They never asked us while in the state, "Don't you feel better? But why don't you submit to God and cast yourselves upon his mercy, embracing the Lord Jesus Christ by faith, who came down from heaven on purpose to save the lost? Turn ye, why will ye die?" I do not say that this law work, as it has been appropriately called, was alike marked and pungent in all cases. It wasn't. He who works all things according to the counsel of his own will opened some hearts as he seemed to have opened that of Lydia. It wants to receive the truth and the love of it. But I am quite sure that in most cases the conversions in that revival were preceded by sharp conviction of sin and of deserved punishment. It was eminently a law revival, issuing in the more abundant and abiding consolations of the gospel. Those loved most who felt that they had been forgiven most. As our pastors were careful not to encourage us that we had passed from death unto life without good scripture evidence of the change, they were very strict in their examinations for church membership. If they thought any of the candidates did not give satisfactory evidence of having been converted, they did not hesitate to tell them so. In this way, not a few were kept back and solemnly exhorted to begin anew and never rest satisfied till they could obtain better evidence. That some real converts may, under their scrutiny, have been thrown into needless alarm and distress, and kept out of the church too long is not improbable, but others afterwards thanked their pastors with tears in their eyes for having dealt with them so faithfully, saying, "We now see that we were building on a false foundation, and if you had encouraged us, we should in all likelihood have settled down upon it and lost our souls." On which side it is safest to err in dealing with newborn hopes, who can doubt? If a person has been truly converted, no degree of strictness in his examination, though it should shake his hope for the time and give him needless distress, can endanger his salvation. Born of God, his seed will remain in him, and a prayerful revision of the ground of his hope may help in the end to strengthen and establish it. Whereas, on the contrary, too much encouragement may induce one who is unconverted to settle down upon a false hope and perish, who to human view might have been saved by the faithful dealing of a spiritual teacher. It is not supposable that the former, when he gets to heaven, will be sorry that his pastor was so strict in examining the foundation of his hope, though it may have given him pain. But it is more than probable that the latter may reproach his minister at the bar of God for healing the hurt slightly. In the revival of which I am now speaking, the pastors called in no evangelists without charge to aid them. They did all the preaching themselves, helping one another as occasion required. This they did by occasional exchanges and oftener at weekly lectures. They also sometimes went round from parish to parish, two and two by appointment. These visits by brethren who came with hearts warmed in revivals at home were very much blessed. I remember them during the revival in Boston, where I was brought up. One of the ministers preached at one service, and the other followed with an address. In the next, the order was reversed, and this was the usual way at those meetings. Besides the two regular services on the Sabbath, there were prayer meetings in the evening. Conferences, they were then called, which the pastors generally attended, aided by some of the lay brethren. One weekday lecture was preached, sometimes two, and evening meetings were held at the schoolhouses, more or less in the out districts of the congregation. Taken altogether, I think there were not so many extra meetings as are common now in powerful revivals. Perhaps there were not enough, though I am not sure. Christians may be so much abroad as to leave but little time for home duties and the family in the closet. Is not this sometimes the case? I think it is. It is easier to sit and listen and enjoy the social meeting than to keep the heart in a humble and devout frame for secret prayer. And I am afraid too many Christians are ready to excuse themselves for lack of punctuality in the latter by thinking that they make it up and more by going to all the meetings. And this leads me to ask, is there not more time spent in secret wrestling with the angel of the covenant in the earlier stages of revivals than in the latter? And if so, may not this neglect be one principal reason why many of these precious seasons are of such short continuance? The ministers of that day held no 4 days or other protracted meetings. They depended much on the preaching of the word upon the Sabbath for the awakening of sinners, and I believe this divinely appointed means was more owned and blessed than perhaps all the auxiliary services put together, important and helpful as they undoubtedly were. Those pastors had no seats set apart for the awaken, nor did they call upon any who wished for special prayer to signify it by rising in the meetings. Much as they rejoiced when many were turned to the Lord, they never, I believe, urged young converts to come forward and take part until they had some time to examine the foundation of their hopes, and it safer than the haste and urgency which are sometimes employed. There is doubtless such a thing as keeping back converts so long that through diffidence they may be unwilling to pray and exhort when their assistance in the prayer meetings would be very acceptable and edifying. This, as well as the opposite extreme, should be guarded against. Pastors want all the good lay help they can get, and every genuine revival brings some men into the church who may be trained up for these auxiliary exercises. Before presenting from labors in these revivals more minute and detailed testimonies to their character and results, I am sure I shall gratify many by drawing from the eloquent public discourses of the Edward Dorr Griffin an expression of his views of the great work of God, the influence of which so distinctly characterized the whole of his brilliant career, and in which he was himself one of the earliest converts. Graduating at Yale College in 1790 at the age of 20, the next year he was taken sick, brought to reflection, and led to consecrate himself to Christ in the ministry. He studied theology with the younger President Edwards, was licensed, and in 1792 found himself at his father's house in East Haddam, Connecticut, the only professor of religion in a family of 10. He labored for their salvation, attended a prayer meeting in the neighborhood, and in November, while one of his sisters was weeping in anguish of spirit, he was making his appeals to those around him. That, he said, was the beginning of American revival, so far as they fell under my personal observation. And from that moment I know they have never ceased. In January, he commenced preaching in New Salem, a neighboring village where his labors were blessed in a revival of great power, and a church was gathered where there had not been one for more than 40 years. And there were, and in the vicinity, about 100 who were hopefully added to the Lord. Speaking of this period, he says, I had an opportunity to see the whole field of death before a bone began to move. And no one who comes upon the stage 40 years afterwards can have any idea of the state of things at that time. Dr. Griffin, in a note at a later period, states that long before the death of George Whitefield in 1770, extensive revivals in America had ceased, and that revivals had been reported to him in Stockbridge and other parts of Berkshire County in 1772, and a part of Lyme about 1780, and in several towns in Litchfield County about 1783. Notices have also appeared of revivals in Princeton College under John Witherspoon, in connection with the labors of Dr. McWhorter in Newark, of Dr. McMillan in western Pennsylvania, 1781 to 1794, of Mr. Caldwell in Elizabethtown in 1772, and another in the same town in 1784. Dr. Burton in Thetford, Vermont, and Reverend Dr. Shepherd, Brentwood, New Hampshire in 1781. Dr. Wood in Boscawen, New Hampshire, Reverend Mr. Halleck in West Simsbury, 1783, Dr. Smalley, Berlin, Connecticut, Dr. Emmons in Franklin, and Reverend Mr. Sanford in Medway, Massachusetts in 1784, and so on. And there were doubtless others, notwithstanding the pervading spiritual dearth. The great and general work of which Dr. Griffin speaks was begun in Virginia earlier than 1792, is already intimated, and as appears in subsequent pages. In closing a sermon preached before the American Board for Foreign Missions at Middletown, Connecticut in 1826, he thus celebrates the grace of God in this revival epoch. For many years, the Christian world had been sunk in a profound slumber in regard to the duty of giving the gospel to the heathen. But for the last 34 years, they have been waking up. He who has engraven Zion on the palms of his hand, who never wants means to fulfill his promises, has sent his heavenly influence to rouse the Christian world. He beheld the desolations of Zion and has come to rebuild her ruined walls. He heard the groans of his people as with harps on the willows they were weeping by the rivers of Babylon, and has come to bring them again to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. Eternal thanks to God for what our eyes have seen and our ears have heard for the last 34 years. Eternal thanks to God for the increasing wonders which are rapidly opening on the world. And oh, can we restrain the bursting emotion? Forever blessed be his great and glorious name for what we have begun to see in our own land. It is more than 30 years since the Christians in Great Britain awoke, and they have been holding on their way with increasing majesty and glory until that little island bestows annually more than $1 million upon strangers. It is 14 years since New England broke her slumbers, and now the mass of her population seems drenched in the missionary spirit. I saw the day cover the plains of Europe. I saw the westward traveling light spread itself over these eastern states. 9 years ago, I saw the rays of the morning tip our Presbyterian horizon. I saw the dawn blush deeper and deeper. I knew it would not all return again to midnight. I knew the sun would rise. At length, I saw his golden limb above the eastern woods, and from the course of day, I knew that soon the heavenly flood would cover all the plains to Arkansas and the Pacific. Already the influence of heaven has dropped upon the wilderness, and the yell of the war whoop has changed to notes of praise. We must not stop till every Indian tongue has joined the general song. We must not stop till our influence has cheered the whole extent of South America. And then we must go forth to the islands and hold on our way till we meet our brethren in other fields and unite with them in completing the harvest of the world. We owe the sincerest gratitude to God for giving us our existence on such a day as this. Many prophets and kings desired to see this day and saw it not. One spirit has seized the Christian world to send the gospel with a great company of its publishers to all the nations of the earth. Missionary and Bible societies, those stupendous monuments of Christian charity, have risen so rapidly and in so great numbers throughout Europe and America that in contemplating them we are like them that dream. These societies have already accomplished wonders and are constantly stretching forward to future achievements beyond the reach of imagination. On the burning sands of Africa, where Christian feet never before trod, there is a holy band of missionaries struggling amid dangers and deaths to lead the sable tribes of Ethiopia to stretch forth their hands to God. On the plains of Hindustan, a consecrated host are translating the scriptures into more than 30 different languages, spoken by a population greater than that of all Europe. On the borders of China, they have produced a version which will give the oracles of God to one quarter of the population of the globe. In the northern islands, a nation is born in a day. From the hill of Zion, from the top of Calvary, they are freighting every caravan of pilgrims with Bibles for all the countries of the East. Certainly the angel has begun his flight through the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to every nation and kindred and tongue and people, end quote. In his sermon, September 1828, at the dedication of the new chapel at Williams College, of which he was then president, Edward Dorr Griffin gives a fuller expression to his views of the influence of these revivals. And turning to the religious history, he says, of the college and its prospective connection with the Redeemer's Kingdom, a subject opens upon us of unbounded interest. The year 1792, it has often been said, ushered a new era into the world. In that year, the first blood was drawn in that mighty struggle which for more than 20 years convulsed Europe and began the predicted destruction of the apocalyptic beast. In that year, the first of those institutions which modern charity has planned and which now cover the whole face of the Protestant world arose in England. The Baptist Missionary Society, formed at Kettering by Andrew Fuller and others. It was my happiness to be early carried by the providence of God to Litchfield County, Connecticut, and to be fixed in that scene where the heavenly influence was to send out its stronger radiations to different parts of the country, where thrice 20 congregations in contiguous counties were laid down in one field of divine wonders. There it was my privilege to be most intimately associated with such men as Samuel Mills and Gillette and Halleck, names which will be ever dear to the church on earth and some of which are now familiar in heaven. Their voices, which I often heard in the silent groves and in the sacred assemblies which followed, and in the many, many meetings from town to town, have identified them in my mind with all those precious revivals which opened the dawn of a new day upon our country. And in that year commenced that series of revivals in America, which has never been interrupted night or day, and which never will be until the earth is full of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Pondering upon the destinies of this college in illumined moments, in moments of intense interest, it has been no indifferent thought that it arose into being at that punctum of time that it opened upon a world, when those other institutions began to open which are full of salvation, when the redemption of Africa commenced at Sierra Leone and St. Domingo, when that moral change began which has swept from so large a part of New England its looseness of doctrine and laxity of discipline, and awakened an evangelical pulse in every vein of the American church. It was my happiness to be early carried by the providence of God to Litchfield County, Connecticut, and to be fixed in that scene where the heavenly influence was to send out its stronger radiations to different parts of the country, where thrice 20 congregations and contiguous counties were laid down in one field of divine wonders. During the first 7 years of the existence of this college, Williams College, of which Edward Dorr Griffin was the president, in which 93 graduated in 6 classes, there were but 5 professors of religion in the institution, exclusive of 2 who, 7 months before the close of that period, were brought into the church by the revivals in Litchfield County. In 3 of those 6 classes, there was not a single professor. From the commencement of 1798 until February 1800, there was but 1 professor of religion in college. The spring of 1806 was made memorable by the admission of those 2 distinguished youth, Gordon Hall and Samuel J. Mills. Mills is the son of my early friend, the Reverend Samuel J. Mills of Torrenford, who was known to me from a child and received his permanent impressions in one of the most glorious revivals I have ever seen. In 1798, though he did not obtain relief till the month of November 1801, he at once devoted himself to the cause of missions, and with a heart glowing with this desire, entered upon his course of education. When he arrived in this town, he found himself in a revival of religion. He could not fail to catch the spirit. He had joined a class in which, to say nothing of the living, there were such men as James Richard and Robert Chauncey Robbins. The Spirit of God fell upon the class. In the life of Mills, it is asserted on the authority of one of his most valued classmates that he was much engaged before the event, and during its continuance was more resorted to than any other by the awakened, and was reputed the principal instrument. And yet his modesty and the peculiar structure of his mind prevented him from taking a conspicuous part in public meetings. In the course of the summer, 8 or 10 of that class became subjects of the work, and 1 or 2 others, among whom was Gordon Hall. This revival, says the author of Samuel Mills' Life, was among the most signal expressions of favor to the church. He alludes to the well-known fact that by means of this influence, Mills prevailed to diffuse through a circle of choice spirits that zeal for missions which actuated his own breast. On Wednesday afternoons, they used to retire for prayer to the bottom of the valley south of the West College, and on Saturday afternoons, when they had more leisure, to the more remote meadow on the bank of the Hoosac. And there under the haystacks, those young Elijahs prayed into existence the embryo of American missions. They formed a society unknown to any but themselves to make inquiries and to organize plans for future missions. They carried the society with them to Andover, where it was roused into missionaries, most that have gone to the heathen, and where it is still exerting a powerful influence on the interests of the world. I have been in situations to know that from the councils formed in that sacred conclave, or from the mind of Mills himself, arose the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, the American Bible Society, the United Foreign Missionary Society, and the African School under the care of the Senate of New York and New Jersey. Besides all the impetus given to domestic missions, to the colonization society, and to the general cause of benevolence in both hemispheres, if I had any instrumentality in originating any of those measures, I here publicly declare that in every instance I received the first impulse from Samuel John Mills. End of chapter. The Revival Epic, 1800, Heman Humphrey.